I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Today's guest and I crossed paths once before, some 20 years ago. In 2001, I took my only foray into directing movies. Matthew Landfield was just out of college, visiting his parents in a dilapidated building on Desbrosses Street in Lower Manhattan that turned out to be part of our set.
I remember you being outside on Desbrosses Street with, was it Jennifer Love Hewitt?
Yes.
So you guys were outside. I remember the Grip and Electric guys come up the stairs, and they had to run some lighting cable through my mom's kitchen window.
Yeah.
You spent more time with my dad that day than
I'm going to get to that story.
I did.
Maybe I should have been looking at the dailies. Like I said, it was my only attempt at directing. But Matthew's dad, Ronnie Landfield, was like someone out of a New York past. He was a modernist painter who'd raised a family there starting in the 70s. Gentrification didn't really begin in Tribeca until after 9/11, much later than in neighboring Soho. When we were shooting, Ronnie's block was just an Italian restaurant and a row of former industrial buildings. In those buildings, dozens of people like him made their homes and their studios. Ronnie invited me upstairs to see his paintings. He was a character, with his cigarettes and a Bronx accent I thought had died off, punching consonants like they were Sonny Liston. I wanted to quit my movie and start a new one about him. Dustin Hoffman would play the lead. The whole scene stuck with me over the decades, and a couple of years ago, I found myself driving down the same block. The building at 31 Desbrosses was gone, an empty lot instead. I searched the address, hoping I might find what would replace it. What I found instead was a brilliant, lyrical, almost obsessively researched 8,000-word essay about that single plot of earth. It's called Requiem for a Living City, and it's the story of 31 Desbrosses for 10,000 years. And who was the author of this epic tale? None other than Ronnie Landfield's son, Matthew.
You know, my mom and dad were probably some of the earlier people to move into Tribeca. A couple of their families that were already there. I didn't come along until another 5, 6, 7 years later. I was born in 1976. There was no school. There was
Whole Foods.
No, there was no Whole
Foods. No ATM, no dry cleaner.
No Whole Foods. I mean, yeah,
there was nothing.
There was nothing down there.
Where'd she go get the groceries?
So we would go to the West Village. There was a grocery store called the Pioneer on Bleecker Street that we would have to walk to. And there was another place called Morgan's on West Broadway, which on
In the dead of winter,
Canal.
You were walking to go get the groceries.
We had to, yeah.
A little house on Canal Street.
I mean, it sounds crazy, but it at that time, it was like living a pioneer lifestyle in the middle of this urban wilderness.
It sounds more like you grew up on a farm.
It was like that. So what happened with the school, I guess, a school called PS3 Annex was opened in 1977 by a pioneering principal, a woman named Blossom Gelertner, and she was very progressive. She had a very kind of open-minded perspective on education, and she opened a school inside of Independence Plaza, which was a large housing development, tiny little school. But in those days, there were so few children that the city didn't want to keep the school open. And a lot of the residents, including my mother, had to fight the city to keep a school in that area of Tribeca. So in the film Pollock, you probably
yes,
know the Ed Harris
Ed,
film,
yeah.
There's a scene where, you know, Pollock and Lee Krasner are talking, and he says, hey, let's make a baby. And she says, no, you know, you need. And she turns him down because they don't have any money. He's kind of crazy. He's, you know, he's got all
he's not
problems.
Father of the year material.
No. Yeah. And so, no, look, my dad is not Jackson Pollock.
Right.
And my mom was not Lee Krasner.
Right.
But they faced a lot of the same issues, a lot of the same challenges. You know, they didn't have a lot of money. My dad grew up in the Bronx. He was basically just a working class kid. And my mom was raised by a single mother in the the East Side. My grandmother was an artist, so she never had any money either. And so my mother lived a very bohemian life. I was going to show you a picture later of one of Klaus Oldenburg's happenings, where my mother was one of the cast members of one of those performance art kind of
things. Was she an actress?
She was a performer, dancer.
Where did they meet?
I think they met in Woodstock, folk dancing or something.
Was your father into that too?
Yeah, they were all into that.
The 60s.
In those early 60s, yeah. Yeah.
If you wanted to meet a woman that you were attracted to, right away you were into whatever she was into. Oh, yeah, I'm into that dancing. Oh, sure, I do that all the time. I know that deal, yeah. My ex-wife said to me, I'm a vegetarian. And I said, so am I. That's so funny. I just had a hamburger like 3 hours ago. I was like, I'm a vegetarian.
Exactly.
Too. Anyway, she was a performer.
So my mom had been a performer. She'd had a clothing store with my grandmother for a little while in the East Village. But, you know, my mother and my father got together in the 60s, and my father at the time was sort of like, I want to say like an enfant terrible of art in a way. Like he was very young compared to so many of his compatriots, but he was very ambitious and very determined.
He was ready for success.
Yeah, very, very driven. And
at his pace.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But, you know, like succeeding in the art world is never easy, even if you are coming at it with lots of resources and support from family money and all kinds of things. And my dad didn't have any of that. He had to fight his own family to become an artist.
Now, what did his dad do?
A delivery man. And he was a working class guy.
And the grandmother that had the apartment in Chelsea was whose mother?
That was my mother's mother. My mother's father was an artist also. He was a graphic artist. He and his brothers they were born in Savannah, Georgia, all of them. There were four of them. But their mother moved them back to Lithuania as children. And so like in the 1920s and 30s, they lived in Lithuania and they had a very, very, very difficult time there. And then when they left, their mother stayed and died in the Holocaust. So my grandfather and his brothers were extraordinarily talented in the arts. They were cartoonists and drawers, basically illustrators. My grandfather's brother is a cartoonist known by the name of Al Jaffe, who does the fold-ins. And my grandfather worked with him for a little while doing cartoons. But my grandfather was I think a little more fragile than Al was, and never really recovered from the loss of his mother in the Holocaust. And so he struggled with depression and basically PTSD for all of my mother's childhood and wasn't around. And so my mother was raised by my grandmother and her grandparents in Forest Hills and whatnot. So,
But I want to get back to your parents.
Yeah, they were sort of like these kind of bohemian kids just kind of on their own. And my mom was very devoted to my father, and my father was very determined, and he...
She was very devoted to your father.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Because she lived under these... I mean, I don't want to describe it like it was that tough, but was the place warm? Did they turn the heat on?
Sometimes.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. So your mom had little kids.
Yeah, so,
and when you say the Pollock reference, was your mother sitting there like, you know, when are we going to get out of here? Or was she down the line, she was with him?
She was.
That's amazing.
Neither of my parents graduated from college. My father attended art school for a short time and decided that wasn't
for him. Pratt?
No, he actually went to the Kansas City Art Institute for a little while, but decided that, you know, all he really wanted to do was paint. Mm-hmm. So he came back to New York and went into painting. My mother didn't finish her college education, and I think that was something that she maybe regretted over time, and sort of was a, you know, she's of a generation of women where that was not as important.
Wasn't typical, yeah.
Right? And so,
did your dad have a gallery that represented him back then? Did he have some success right away?
He did. In the late '60s, he was right in there with a lot of important painters and sculptors who were doing.
I'm not just saying this. I love your dad's painting.
Oh, good. I'm sure he would love to hear you say that. You know,
things were working.
Yeah. By the time I came along, my dad had already dealt a reputation in the art world, was selling his paintings pretty regularly, and their housing was affordable.
Which is important for your career.
For an artist, it's everything. So I come along, and then my brother comes along. And then what happens in 79, actually, when the year that you came to New York, the rent was tripled. And all of a sudden, this manageable life becomes a little bit more difficult. And my dad still continued through the early 80s to have success in the art, in the arts, selling his work. But it became harder. It just was harder. And of course, you have a family.
Yeah,
you have two
same.
Children.
And they're only getting more expensive.
Things are more challenging. And so, you know, I would not say that their life was a panacea. It was a challenge.
Yeah.
It was always difficult.
And he lasted there how much longer?
I mean, they lived there until 2012.
2012. So when I saw him, because I want to paint this picture quickly before I forget, which is, and again, this is where you're really going to correct me if I'm wrong, because when I tell this story, I always turn your father into like a Dustin Hoffman character, you know what I mean? Like Dustin Hoffman would play your father.
He doesn't have a very heavy
New York accent, correct? Because I play him like he's got a really thick New York accent.
You know, my wife would say that he does, but he doesn't really. Like, there's certain words that he... That
in my movie really version of this, your dad is a really super thick New York guy, and he smoked.
Yeah, he did.
Because this is what I remember. I'm standing out in front of this building, and your dad shows up, and it's freezing cold.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, and he starts talking to me. He goes, you're making a movie here? And I'm like, yeah, we're making it. He's like, yeah, you're Alec Baldwin, right? You were like an actor, right? I'm like, yeah, I'm directing this movie. He's like, yeah, yeah. I go, you live here? He's like, yeah, I live here with my wife. I'm a painter. And he lights a cigarette. And I go, you got an extra cigarette on you? And I love when people look at me like, you're a rich movie star and you're bumming a cigarette off of me and I'm living in this loft in Desprosa Street? Sure, okay, I'll give you a smoke. Here we go. And I'm sitting there smoking a cigarette with your father on the street and just something happened to me. I'm like, I got to live in this building. I want to live in this building. I want to get a whole floor of this building.
Yeah.
I want to have like a section of this building to myself and I'm going to blow it all up and fix it all up and blah, 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 blah. But he lasted till 2012.
Yeah, I mean, they basically
they
never
were forced
left until
to leave.
Hurricane Sandy really kind of...
Sandy. Where were you at the time?
I was living in Brooklyn with my family.
So you've never left the city, have you? In terms
for
of
college, but I haven't lived in other places.
Where'd you go again?
I went to college in Vermont at a place called Middlebury College.
I know Middlebury, yeah. I love Middlebury. You went to Middlebury 4 years?
4 years.
What'd you study?
I studied theater. I studied filmmaking, geography, you know, a range of things.
A little tapas.
Yeah, mostly acting, mostly theater, mostly film.
What did you want to do?
I wanted to be an actor when I got out of school and then a filmmaker.
Right, which is what you're doing now.
Which is what I do now, yeah.
Now, so 2012, so he leaves only because, so he would have stayed.
There had been many years of legal battles with the landlord, and it's, you know, long...
They want to get everybody out of
thing.
There.
They, you know, they had basically been living with the specter of eviction from 79 till, you know, 2012, 2013, the whole time they were there. Eventually, though, their place was rent stabilized. Everyone in the building, their units were rent stabilized, and they had a right to stay.
So then the storm comes.
So in Sandy, you know, and my father's studio is on the ground floor, and, you know, my father... being who he is, it's a little bit crazy. They stayed in the building. They were there the whole time. They did not evacuate. He didn't want to leave his work. He didn't want to leave the place. So he witnessed the whole neighborhood flood.
Where'd he go?
They went up to some of the upper levels of the building because the other folks
I
had
left. I see your father in my Dustin Hoffman movie. He's smoking a cigarette, looking out the window going, I'm not leaving. Everybody else is leaving. I'm not going anywhere.
You're pretty much right. That's exactly how he was. He said the lights went out. The cars flooded up to almost the roof of the cars. And, you know, that was like that for about 3 hours. And then the water went away. And, you know, that part of the city is in a tidal estuary. The basement of our building would flood a lot over the many years because it was landfill and it was technically part of the river. And so that wasn't a surprise to him, but the flooding in the street was, he had never seen that. And I asked him the other day about it and he said never, ever, 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 ever in the 43 years of their life there had he ever seen flooding. That was the big one.
Interesting how people who don't know that about landfill, and maybe you know this because your article speaks to a lot of that history, which, if I'm not mistaken, just as excavated material from the World Trade Center was responsible for some of the build-out of Battery Park.
Absolutely.
It was excavation from the subway system that built out some of Tribeca, correct or no?
No. Governor's Island, for example, is mostly the excavation from the Lexington Avenue subway, right? But Tribeca, because that strip of land was landfilled between 1803 and 1829.
So there was no subway then.
No subway at that time. Most of it probably came from the leveling of hills in Manhattan, because Manhattan had a lot of hills in those days, and also oyster shells and garbage and broken ships.
Bodies.
And like that. Undoubtedly.
Right. People who drowned in rent-controlled buildings.
Probably, yeah, exactly.
So the flood comes, and what happens?
The flood comes, and they did have to leave. Right. They did have to leave, and basically the city went through the neighborhood and declared their building.
Condemned.
They condemned that building, yes. Right. And then
did the tenants fight that?
They did have to fight that, and there was a court case, which was, there was a little article in the New York Times about it. You know, there was a lot of contention about, you know, the state of the building before Sandy had not been great because it hadn't been maintained, and the landlord objected and all this stuff. I can't totally disclose all of the details because there was a settlement, it resolved, and then they decided to leave.
Upstate?
Yeah, to the Hudson Valley.
They went to the Hudson Valley. So did they try to make it work in New York before they went to the Hudson Valley?
You know, my father is a, and I'm sure he'll listen to this and chuckle.
I hope so. But oh, you know, he likes me doing my impersonation. Come on. I'm spot on here. Come on.
I think you're...
It's a terrible impersonation. But I just think that's my memory with this tough-looking, gnarly guy. I'm like, I'm a painter, see? Yeah, come up and see my paintings. I mean, he was such a New Yorker to me.
He was. He was. He's got a little more of the Bronx in there, I think, than that. But, you know, the thing with him he's someone who likes to stay. He's a very grounded person. So his initial impulse was to move back to the Bronx.
But he needed a studio.
Yeah. I mean, the fact of the matter is my father had a big studio in Lower Manhattan, and there is no way that you can replicate that.
Talk about what happened to Tribeca price-wise.
Tribeca, but Brooklyn, forget about it. Even parts
we're going to talk about that, too.
And so...
So we can't replicate it in the Bronx. The Bronx is getting torn down now, too.
The Bronx...
All my friends that are real estate executives, that's the not even the next. They're there now. They're tearing everything down. They're talking about $1 million and $2 million condos overlooking Yankee Stadium. That's going to be your view. I mean, they're talking about two movie studios they're building up there. Silver Cup went up there.
Absolutely.
They're all going to take their properties in Queens, tear that down, build housing.
Yeah.
I'm not going to name names, but some of them can tear their spaces down, some can't.
If there's a financial incentive, you know, in New York, there's...
The land is worth more money as residential housing overlooking the river. You're right over there on the foot of the 59th Street Bridge in Long Island City.
Yeah.
Some people who will remain nameless that I know have told me they're going to go up to the Bronx and move their whole operation up to the Bronx.
You know, that wasn't my father's first impulse, was to move up there. And my brother...
Where he's from.
Exactly.
That's funny.
Yeah. My brother and I kind of invade upon him to look a little further out. And so, you know, he found a place that where he was able to build a new studio.
He built one.
Yeah, he built one.
So his settlement and everything put him in a position where he was comfortable. You're doing okay.
So he built a new studio, which was the right thing for him to do. He got a place where he could live and work comfortably.
So is he up there, and a year goes by, and does he turn to your mother and go, man, we should have done this 20 years ago?
You know...
Did he just really sit there and go, why did I break my ass to stay in Manhattan? Or does he miss New York?
Every time I visit them, we have this conversation.
What does he say?
We go through it over and over again. And, you know, he does miss Tribeca and misses that neighborhood because there are a lot of things about it that made it a wonderful place to be. And it is sad to be gone from there.
But are the things he likes, are there pluses about being up there?
It's lovely being away from the city, too. Yeah. And I think that... when we think about what Tribeca has become, what their neighborhood became in the time, even before Sandy.
That building they're putting up in place of that building is like a strange-looking building.
Yeah, I mean, but...
It looks like something made of Legos.
Their community, the people who were there when they came, all of them are gone. They either have been bought out or forced out or passed away. And you know, it's a generational turnover.
Isn't it funny how people don't realize? I mean, in my lifetime, I mean, I came here... And that was the dawn of the build out of Soho, and then Tribeca beyond that, and then Battery Park. Did you ever imagine that apartments would sell for $30 million right around the corner from where you grew up?
I mean, it is. I mean, I think it's unrealistic in a lot of ways. But at the same time,
everybody wants to live there.
That's reflective of the bigger trends in our economy and our politics and our world.
Talk about that
right now. I mean,
talk about how it plays out in New York.
Well, I mean, New York is not divorced from the economy of the United States. It's part of it, and it always has been.
Right.
You go all the way back to the very, very beginning of that neighborhood of Tribeca in those days, to Alexander Hamilton and the things that they were dealing with after the Revolution. And if you look through my piece about the evolution of that particular neighborhood, it's always been connected to the economy of America. And right now is no different. And right now we're living in a plutocracy where you have, you know, billionaires right and left, and they really have unfettered power to buy and sell real estate, and that is very clearly distorting the marketplace and the broader economy.
Matthew Landfield on changes at 31 Desprosa Street and around the globe. The battle between preservation and development in New York can be brutal. Perhaps New York's most prominent preservationist is Andrew Berman. He's the one who led the charge to landmark the iconic streets of Southern Greenwich Village.
After 50 years of people trying to get that area landmarked, we were able to get it landmarked in two stages.
What did it take?
We actually had to almost blackmail the city. They wanted to get an area adjacent to that rezoned as a SOP to a developer, Trinity Real Estate in this case. And we pushed the city council to say, we won't approve the rezoning that you, the city, want unless you move ahead with this landmarking that the community has been asking for years.
Hear the rest of that interview at heresthething.org. More with Matthew Landfield coming up. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. No political battle in recent memory has crystallized attitudes about gentrification more than Amazon's proposal to build its second headquarters in the Queens neighborhood of Long Island City.
Overnight, the real estate values in Long Island City went through the roof.
Right.
And, you know, I think that that's just another indicator of aspects of our economy that are just broken. I think that's true of the whole city in a lot of ways, especially Manhattan. You know, it's very manicured in a way. And it's, I don't want to say it's never going to go back, because one thing that I found in doing the research into the history of where I grew up was that the city waxed and waned.
Did it really? Describe a period where it waned.
Well, between 1870 and 1940, all of Lower Manhattan was this massive
port,
just a gigantic shipping
docks.
hub from the very tip of the Battery all the way up, goods and all kinds of foods and services, until after the Second World War, when shipping transformed into container shipping. The technology of container ships was developed, these enormous tanker-sized ships that could ship more, that could ship faster, and it was less expensive.
Right.
So all of that moved to the Port of Elizabeth in New Jersey. That meant that the entire West Side became a ghost town.
Yeah.
And you have this sort of vacuum of space, and into that vacuum, artists start to...
Ronnie Landfield shows up and wants a loft.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's one version of how the city, that part of the city, has waxed and waned. But even before that, when the neighborhood was first settled by Trinity Church, because Trinity Church owned a lot of the land down there, and still does own a lot of land. Trinity owns a lot of stuff. Trinity owns this building. So after the Revolution, the church had burned down. During the war, there was a terrible fire, burned down. They had to rebuild the church. And the congregation grew, and the city was starting to grow, and so they wanted to expand, and they wanted to build a new church a little further north, just north of City Hall. And so they built a chapel called St. John's Chapel, which was on Vestry and Varick. And in front of the church, they built a park called St. John's Park or Hudson Square. And that park was a private park. There were houses that were
like Gramercy Park.
In fact, was the model for Gramercy Park and Washington Square Park. Okay. They built houses around the park, and they wanted basically wealthy people who were mostly living down on like Broadway and further south, like closer to Wall Street. They wanted them to move in there, and so that neighborhood becomes a wealthy kind of very genteel enclave around the park between 1820 and 1850. But then you have the railroad. Cornelius Vanderbilt builds the Hudson River Railroad line along Hudson Street and starts running trains up and down to ship things back and forth. And the residents of that neighborhood don't want to be close to the railroad, and so they start to leave. And so by 1867—
they fled that area.
They're completely out of the area, and the park is sold and converted into a rail yard by Vanderbilt. And so— again, you have this sort of waxing and waning of life in a particular area.
Growth and death.
Mostly partly due to technological change. I mean, you have the coal-powered steam engine. You have railroads.
Vanderbilt was the Jeff Bezos of his era.
He was like that. Exactly, exactly. And so—
But what I want you to get to is, what was the genesis of this piece you wrote?
So after Sandy, my parents left. They moved up to the Hudson Valley. And a lot of the buildings down there were empty. And obviously something was going to be done with them. I didn't know what. They knocked down the building. It was demolished in end of 2014, early 2015. And, you know, that was painful to experience. It was very painful, actually. Yeah. It was very sad. And I had a lot of feelings about it. And at the time, I had actually been recently laid off from a demanding job, and I was kind of burned out, and I wanted to do something a little bit different. And I went down there one day, and the building was completely gone, and I was looking down into the foundation, and I was like, well, wait a minute, what's in there? Like, I wondered, I was like, oh, were there, you know, American Indians who lived there? Is there like some archaeological history in there? I want to know what was under there, because I never thought about the building as not being there, and then number two, like what it was on in the first place. That started me off in this sort of inquiry, and I didn't plan to write anything. I didn't plan to tell anybody. I just was going to answer the question for myself. And so I started digging into it, and I found a lot of interesting stuff that in collecting the material and looking into it, the only way I could make sense of it was to write it all down and compile it into some form that could communicate both my feelings about the experience of having grown up in this place, as well as what I was learning about the history of the place and perhaps what the future of the place might be. So that was really the genesis of writing that particular
piece. How long did it take you to write the piece? There's like copious research involved in this piece.
I got a little carried away. Yeah. You know, in answering these questions.
It's very nuggety, this piece.
It has a lot of stuff in it. And I did do a fair amount of research. I'd spent a lot of time in the library, which I have to say, if anyone is interested in supporting an institution, the New York Public Library is probably the best one I can think of right now. And I just kept finding things that I was like, oh my God, look at these photographs. Look at this material of St. John's Park or these images of the docks in Lower Manhattan in 1899 or whatever. Like, and all of this is gone. Like, these are phantoms that have been forgotten about but made the city what it is. They're the reason why I was there at all. And I wanted to capture that and share it.
Your
and
dad also, moved in 1969.
They moved, yeah. My mom and dad moved there in 69. And when they moved there, that building had been empty for probably at least 5 years, had been an industrial manufacturing building where they made pertussin cough syrup. There was no bathroom. There was no kitchen. There was nothing. When artists moved into that neighborhood at that time, they were moving into largely commercial spaces, renting them on like 10-year commercial leases and living there, which was technically illegal.
Illegal. What do they do about the facilities that they didn't have? Where do they?
They put them in.
They put in
hardwood floors, yeah, and the kitchens and bathrooms and stuff.
And your dad did that.
Yeah. And rent was
cheap.
You know.
So the owners who had run it as the industrial building, they were commercial landlords.
Yes.
Let them come in there. They just turned a blind eye.
Yes.
When I came to New York in 1979, it was the beginning of the flip of Soho. And you'd read in the Village Voice, you'd read about, you know, the battle to save industrial space in New York. And everyone kept saying, well, maybe it'll come back. And eventually you get to the, I don't know what year was, 77, 78, 79, where it's basically ruled they're not coming back. And they allow the residential build out of Soho.
Yeah.
This place was a bolt factory. This place was a sewing machine factory on Green Street, yes, or Westboro, and they're all gone. And you're in front of all these cast iron buildings and they're about to flip. But Tribeca was behind that.
Right, exactly. I mean, also under the Lenape, because the Lenape Indians were the original inhabitants of Manhattan, what I didn't really know was that there hadn't been people there before. It had been the river. That particular strip of Lower Manhattan
was filled.
It had originally, like when European settlers got there in the very, very beginning, all of that was the river, and it was filled in over the course of several years. And I found who filled it in. I found out who
filled it in.
Well, what happens is between 1790 and 1803, the city starts to sell the water rights to the coast of the island and say, we will sell the rights to the coast.
If you develop it.
If you develop it. And so real estate speculators, a guy named Hugh Gain is one of them. He was a printer. He was a publisher. He was a real estate speculator. Kind of was a little bit on both sides of the war in the revolution.
Why not?
Right. He buys the particular lots there and starts to develop.
And the river divided up into lots.
Yeah, they divide it up into lots. And so what he does is, or what they do is they first they build these wharves. I guess the little wharves are called cob wharves, and then they start to kind of like fill in the space in between them with junk, with oyster shells, with detritus from the city, from earth from hills that have been leveled further inland on the island. And over the course of about 25 years, the West Street areas developed. So like, you know, Washington Street is filled in, then the block west of Washington is filled in, and then there's West Street. Now, that edge of the island was still pretty rough, even all the way up until about 1870, when the city goes in and really standardizes.
Of course,
and
it must be a massive engineering project.
It took a long time. But so I found that. And what that told me was that when Sandy flooded Lower Manhattan, the high water mark lines up with the contours of the island before it was settled. It you can overlay the. I found this amazing.
It's a ghost.
It is. It is like that. You can overlay the 1609 version of Manhattan to Sandy, the inundation zone, and it lines up right in there. And
God doesn't like Tribeca.
Okay. No,
he doesn't want Tribeca there.
Maybe doesn't like the settlement so much. I don't know because. Yeah. Before Hugh Gain, before settlement, before they developed it, it was swamp.
I suppose the word is takeaway or what have you. But when you look back on, you spent a lot of time writing this.
Yeah,
you spent a lot of time researching. There's a lot of research that went in this. And when you're done, how do you feel about what's happened to the property, your home? Have you made peace with that, or are you still?
Yeah. So it's a place that I love. It's my home. It's the village in which I was raised. Regardless of the economics, regardless of who's living there, regardless of the historic preservation or the real estate or whatever, my takeaway is that my home is in jeopardy from climate change. I think that that particular place is at risk of being an uninhabitable place in a generation or two. And doesn't matter if you make a lot of money or if you are just a normal person working to make a living. We're facing a threat that requires us to confront together, or else we will have to retreat.
To other boundaries, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, well, with my family, we had to go. We said to my father, you can't stay there.
Yeah.
Because if there's another Sandy, you won't make it through.
Yeah.
So we chose to move to higher ground. You know, there will be people who will listen to this and think that I'm crazy. Look at the property values, and you can still make so much money, and apartments down there, and they're selling for millions and millions. And the true threat from climate change may be far off. But for us, it's in the rearview mirror, right? New York is an island on an estuary. It's surrounded by water. We are not immune, and there are a lot of people with a lot of precious things here that are at risk.
Right.
And we have to either solve our political problems and start dealing with it, or we have to make a plan. And I have not heard any politician or leader adequately address the scale of what we're truly dealing with.
Well, not in this country.
And not in this country. I mean, you know, I think, you know, I will say, like, God bless her, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one of the few who's actually saying it. And here's the other thing about it. We're not good at dealing with problems that are beyond our imagining. If I told you on September 10th, 2001, that by noon the next day, the two towers would be gone.
Eviscerated, yeah.
Completely, and thousands of people would be dead. Most people mm-hmm. would have thought you were crazy if you had said that. But the next day, what happened? And I remember seeing those buildings and the hole in the from the plane and thinking, how are they going to fix that? How are they going to repair that?
Yeah.
And it didn't occur to me that they weren't going to be able to fix it. That there are some things, there are some problems that you just cannot
fix.
And I think that with a situation like we're facing, with what is coming with climate change, it is one of those problems. And so either we address the problem and do what we have to do to cut emissions or whatever it is, whatever those policy things are,
to try. We're not even trying right now.
We're not even trying. Our politics are so broken we can't
even
try.
Yeah.
If that is the case, then we have to say, okay, what does that mean? If it means that the whole neighborhoods are going to flood, we have to be prepared for how do we get people out of that?
Right.
At high tide, the Lenape, they could canoe from the East River up a creek into the Collect Pond, which is now where the Center Street Courthouse is, across another creek to the Hudson without getting out of the boat.
Right.
And if you look at projections of what climate change will do in Lower Manhattan,
it may be possible
again.
Author and filmmaker Matthew Lanfield on the past, present, and future of his native soil. His article is called Requiem for a Living City, Notes on a Home in Tribeca, and it's available on his website, mattlanfield.com. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is a production of WNYC Studios.